From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.
I really wish my mother could be here tonight. I wish she could see what a wonderful mother Chelsea has become and could meet our beautiful granddaughter, Charlotte. And of course, I wish she could see her daughter become the Democratic Party's nominee.
Hillary Clinton speaking in New York last night after becoming the first woman to claim the mantle of presumptive nominee for president of a major party. She won 4 of 6 contests yesterday: California, New Jersey, New Mexico, and South Dakota. Bernie Sanders took Montana and North Dakota. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead politics editor. He is with us now. Hi, Domenico.
Good afternoon.
Well, first of all, big night for Hillary Clinton last night and in American history. Your thoughts?
It certainly is. I mean, women didn't get the right to vote until 1920, less than 100 years ago. And you think about the struggles in the 1970s, even women of my mother's generation who couldn't even wear pants to work and needed their husband's names on bank accounts. All that has changed. And for younger women, they didn't grow up in that kind of thing. But for Hillary Clinton and for a lot of women in this country who did go through that, this is a significant moment and it shouldn't be underplayed.
And yet it was underplayed by the rival of Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders. In his speech last night, he only made one fleeting mention of Clinton. Let's listen.
And tonight I had a very gracious call from Secretary Clinton and congratulated her on her victories tonight.
They're all booing her. Very negative reaction there. And if you look at the math, as you've talked about a million times, there's not a way for him to get the nomination really at this point, is there, Domenico?
No, there's not. But, the ends of campaigns are difficult. And when you invest a lot of time and effort into a candidate that you truly believe in and it doesn't work out for you, there are bitter feelings. And Senator Sanders didn't concede yet. But remember, Hillary Clinton did not concede in 2008, the night that Barack Obama was named the presumptive nominee. Now, she did so 4 days later. And a lot of this sentiment and feeling that did persist in 2008 in that bitter primary, it's all going to depend on what Senator Sanders does and how he reacts in the coming days.
And one of the things we're all watching is what's going to happen in Washington tomorrow when he's supposed to meet with President Obama. Now, 8 years ago, Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, had to play this broker role between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama when they were sorting things out after it became clear he'd be the nominee. But what will happen this time?
Well, I don't think that Bernie Sanders is going to take his fight to flip superdelegates all the way through next month to the convention. I think that he will try to take his message to the convention. I think that he'll try to remake the party in his image. They will fight to try to get to reduce the number of superdelegates or get rid of them altogether. A lot of process things that he's going to fight for. But there are potential things that the Senate can maybe give him when you think about influence on a lot of the issues that do matter to him. He's been in Washington 25 years and would like to have more influence in the mainstream of the party. But you are hearing something of a change in tone, or started to, where he talked about he would reassess his candidacy after the voting took place in those 6 states last night. And you're starting to see liberal groups like MoveOn.org and Democracy for America, who have said that whoever wins the majority of pledged delegates should be the nominee. That is Hillary Clinton. She also accomplished that last night. Forget superdelegates. She won a majority of the pledged delegates, those votes that matter based on the actual vote.
NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Still more to watch, and we'll be watching tomorrow as Bernie Sanders goes to Washington. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And I'm just back from California, where we were covering the primaries. And in that state, it wasn't just presidential candidates on the ballot. Californians were also voting in the primary for the state's first open Senate seat in 24 years. And they chose 2 Democrats, both minority women, State Attorney General Kamala Harris and Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez. Scott Schaefer is senior editor for California Politics and Government at KQED. He's with us from San Francisco. Scott, how does that work to have 2 Democrats end up on the ballot in November for the Senate seat?
First time that's ever happened, Jeremy. It's under a new system. We have our top 2 primary system in California, where everybody gets the same ballot other than the presidential ballot, but the Senate, governor, all those races, those legislative races. So Republicans, Democrats can vote for whoever they want, crossover to whatever party. And whoever comes in first and second faces off in November. And in this case, it was 2 Democrats, Attorney General Kamala Harris and Orange County Democratic Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez, who were 1-2. And so there will be no Republican on the ballot candidate in November for that race to replace Barbara Boxer in the U.S. Senate.
Were any of the Republicans close? I mean, was it?
Not really. So Loretta Sanchez came in second with about 18.5%. The closest Republican had 8%. There were now a dozen different Republicans running, none of them well known, but they all split the vote. There was no one that really consolidated the vote in a way that might have given them a chance to come in second. It really was never close. And this is what the polls reflected all the way up to the election. It wasn't a surprise.
Well, I just want our listeners to hear a little bit from each of them so they can hear who the next senator from California may be. This is Kamala Harris.
We are speaking as Californians, understanding again that our diversity is our strength. We understand that we have so many challenges as a country, and we are prepared to lead.
And here is Loretta Sanchez.
And this is a story that all Americans and all Californians can agree on, Republicans and Democrats and independents, the American dream. That is what we all want.
Scott, just a few seconds left, but Jerry Brown, the governor, had endorsed Kamala Harris. Does she have the edge going into November?
Oh, very much so. She's got the support. She's got money. She's got endorsements, name ID. She is really the person to beat, and it would be extraordinary if she lost. But it's interesting. We've got two women, two Democrats, Loretta Sanchez, the daughter of immigrants, yeah. Kamala Harris, half African-American, half Asian Indian. So it'll be an interesting race, but Harris definitely has a big edge.
Scott Schaefer, senior editor for California Politics and Government at KQED in San Francisco. Scott, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, both presumptive presidential candidates are looking for the Hispanic vote. How does that search intersect with health care? Hillary Clinton says she wants to improve upon President Obama's health care act. Donald Trump says he'll replace it with something terrific. But Hispanics have seen some of the greatest gains in health coverage thanks to Obamacare, although disparities remain. In Colorado, the Affordable Care Act is a big topic this election year, and newly insured Hispanics are taking note. Here and now contributor Colorado Public Radio's John Daly reports.
19-year-old Cecilia Loya is a community college student from Commerce City, Colorado.
At the beginning, well, we had no Medicaid.
She says for years, her family basically did without health care, unless it was an emergency.
We didn't want to go because we couldn't afford, you know, a doctor's appointment, dentist appointment, any other case like that.
Her dad owns and runs a small concrete company, and her mother is a homemaker. When Medicaid expanded in Colorado as part of the Affordable Care Act, more than 300,000 people signed up, including Loya and her parents.
Now I'm able to go to the dentist, and it doesn't come out of my pocket, and as well as, you know, going to a doctor's appointment to get a checkup or anything like that.
Hispanics like Loya represent a large share of the Coloradans who've signed up for insurance under Obamacare. According to the annual Colorado Health Access Survey, the Hispanic uninsured rate has now dropped 10 percentage points down to less than 12%.
I think it's had a huge impact.
Jim Garcia runs Clinica Tepeyac. The clinic serves a heavily Hispanic working class neighborhood in Denver. Its patients include undocumented Hispanics who don't qualify for health insurance and legal residents who do.
I think in general, I think it's been very positive, you know, especially for the low-income members of our community that were going without insurance. You know, they were just kind of hoping and rolling the dice, hoping that no one got really sick.
But with the gains have come challenges, according to Juan Espino. Espino worked as a health coverage guide, signing up new insurance enrollees. But he says it was a steep learning curve for many families to understand everything from premiums to deductibles to in-network providers.
A lot of people just really don't know what it meant to have health insurance. It was very new to them.
Despite gains in coverage, the rate of uninsured Hispanics is still more than double that of non-Hispanic white residents. That's according to the Colorado Health Access Survey. The survey also found that a growing number of Hispanics also say they're not getting the care they need. Espino says some are struggling with costs that come with health insurance. That includes both the newly insured and Hispanics who already had health insurance before the ACA.
Something that I've heard a lot is that their premiums are getting a little high, and also their deductibles are high.
Hispanics can expect to hear a lot about the pros and cons of Obamacare in the coming months of this election year.
¿Y qué nos ofrece, Senador Mark Udall? Falsas promesas. Mark
Udall. That's an ad from the well-funded free market advocacy group, the Libre Initiative. In 2014, it took out ads aimed at linking the state's incumbent U.S. Senator, Mark Udall, and other Democrats to Obamacare and healthcare costs.
Health insurance doesn't equate to health care.
That's Daniel Garza, the group's executive director, a former George W. Bush White House staffer. He thinks the topic is still fertile ground, but won't say specifically what ads the group plans for 2016. He says the Libre initiative will actively highlight the ACA's shortcomings with Hispanics.
A lot of Latinos are now withholding health care because they can't afford the deductibles or the out-of-pocket costs.
Democrats and progressives are expected to counter that argument by spotlighting coverage gains among Hispanics. It's a fast-growing demographic that now numbers more than a million people in Colorado. That's a fifth of the population in a state that could help determine both the presidency and control of the U.S. Senate. For Here and Now, I'm John Daly in Denver.
All this week, we're remembering Muhammad Ali. Today, his role as hero. Davis Miller was one of millions of young people inspired by Ali's 1964 fight with Sonny Liston, and he probably wasn't the only one who would later knock on Ali's door. But Miller's knock led to a lifelong friendship and writing like 1989's My Dinner with Ali, 1997's The Tao of Ali, and his new book, Approaching Ali, which is also an opera and may soon be a movie. Davis Miller joins us. And you know, you were a scrawny white kid. He was a towering black icon. Improbably, you became family. So first, our condolences.
Thank you. I'll miss him every day. With every breath for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
There will never be another, as he often said of himself.
Yeah. Well, describe that moment as a child. What were you, I think?
I was 11, and my mom had just died.
Yeah.
Unexpectedly at 32 of a kidney disease we didn't know she'd had. I was quite the mother's boy and blamed myself for her death, which kids will do a lot, and quit eating, quit even taking fluids, and it was admitted to hospital a couple of times. And when I got out the second time, I was sitting sadly in front of my dad's little black and white television, and suddenly I landed on a channel, and there was this voice and this face, and the voice said, "I'm young, I'm handsome, I'm fast, I'm pretty, and can't possibly be beat." And it lit me up. It at least internally, it brought me out of my depression, and I lived vicariously through Ali all through my otherwise tough adolescence. At 16 and 17, I was 4'10", weighed 63 pounds. Oh. My high school nickname was Fetus.
Oh.
So not good times. But I had this place inside of me that no one could touch, where internally at least I was the great Ali.
Well, you write about finding an old cotton laundry bag that you filled with socks and rags, hung it from a ceiling beam. Who didn't do this? You know, pulled on a pair of your dad's cotton work gloves and tried to push your worm of a left arm, I think you call it at one point, into his.
Yes, yes. Those were wonderful experiences in a lot of ways. They sound painful, but somehow, you know, I got through them. With Ali as inspiration, as did millions of us, assuredly. Mm. And then I became a professional athlete because of his influence in my early 20s. I was a kickboxer, had the opportunity to spar with him at his training camp in Deer Lake, Pennsylvania. But years later, when I found out I wasn't going to be Ali Jr. or Bruce Lee Jr., I was clerking in movie stores, in old video stores in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. Mm. I didn't think about Ali anymore. He'd been a childhood obsession. I was more concerned with my day-to-day, paying the mortgage, two young kids, young wife, and was called to the home office in Cincinnati, thought I was getting a promotion, and was told instead I was losing my job. And I was driving home from Cincinnati back to Louisville, morose again, and coincidentally drove past the home I knew to be Muhammad Ali's mother's house. And there was this block-long, ivory-colored Winnebago parked in front with license plates that read, "The Greatest." Now, I mean, who else could that be, especially in Louisville, but my childhood idol? And I got nervous, worked up my courage, and decided I got to thank this guy for what he's meant to my life. And went up and got ready to knock on the door of the Winnebago, and he opened the door. This was Easter weekend, 1988. He was so huge, he had to lean under the frame of the doorway to see me. And he stood there looking as big as God, you know, looking like some grand lighted house on a hill, and just glowing.
Well, and thus begins this lifelong close friendship. But even that one night, you see the Parkinson's in him. You see how his step is shortened. But you sit down and read him the story that you wrote for Sports Illustrated when you were in college about his impact on you. He reads that. He obviously is touched by this. He brings you in the house. The next thing you know, you're having dinner with his mother and brother. You're going to rent movies with him. You're out on the lawn sparring again with him. People are pulling up and watching. Are you thinking in this moment, what happened here?
What I'm thinking is my life has been changed. You know, I knew it in the moments, but I didn't know how. I knew this was seminal. It couldn't have felt more out of body. It was an amazing moment. It was like being in love for the first time. And by the time I left the house that evening, I knew I had to write about it.
Well, your story, My Dinner with Ali, is considered one of the great sports writing pieces of the 20th century.
Thank you.
And so I'll just pull out a line about Louisville. Back to hazy orange sunsets and ancestors' unmarked graves, back to old, slow-walking family, empty sidewalks, peach cobblers made by heavy, round-breasted aunts wearing flower dresses, back to short, thin uncles with their straw hats. This was just your sense of being there in Louisville. But this one line that jumps out that seems to say so much about what was happening that night. Muhammad Ali said to you, "I remember what it was like to meet Joe Louis and Rocky Marciano for the first time. They were my idols. I'd seen their fights and faces so many times I felt I knew them. Want to treat you right. Don't want to disappoint you."
That's the way he lived his life, right there. If you'd gone up to his door 2 months ago, Robin, even with him being late-stage Parkinsonism, and you knocked on it like I did, and he happened to be there that day and was feeling healthy that day, it wouldn't matter who you were. He would have invited you and yours to spend the night. He was extraordinary in that almost no matter what was going on in his personal life, he had the ability to step outside of himself and take nurturing interest in almost everyone around him.
Yeah.
Astounding.
Another point, you get very upset. And by now, you're best friends. You've been together for the day. Now it's, you know, after 11 and you're sitting on Lazy Boys in his living room kind of scratching your butts and watching movies. I mean, it's just kind of amazing that, you know, how this progresses. As you write, he yawns like only you do in front of family, right?
Yes.
You get upset about what you're seeing here, this great man brought down by this illness. And he says to you, "I know why this happened. God's showing me and showing you that I'm just a man, just like everybody else."
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, you don't have to make anything up with Ali. This guy lived like poetry in everything from the way he moved to the lyricism of his speech. And the one genius of sport, and I think very likely one of the greatest Americans and greatest people who's ever lived anywhere in the world.
Well, the story is amazing. I hope it makes it to film. You know, you go out in his Winnebago to get videos to watch, and he cuts off some teens who give him the finger. He gives them the finger back. I mean, but that's one night. Your friendship goes on. You become, you know, almost family. And at one point, set this up for us. You were visiting with Ali with your own son.
Yes. Of course, Ali had saved me in some sense as this troubled kid. And for Muhammad's 50th birthday and my 40th, we share a birthday, exactly 10 years apart. I wanted to take my own 6-year-old son to meet Muhammad for the first time. And so we drove from North Carolina, where we lived, oh, I don't know what that would be, 1,200 miles, up to Muhammad's home in Berrien Springs, Michigan. We stayed there for 3 days, hanging out, Ali playing with my son, hiding behind furniture, jumping out to tickle him, get him down on the floor, saying, "I'm the mummy. I'm Frankenstein. I'm going to eat you up." And it was an amazing time. And as we get ready to leave, Ali walks us out to the car, and it's snowing. I'm concerned that he might fall. This is 1992, and he's already had Parkinson's disease for approaching 20 years. His balance isn't good. He's wearing slick-soled street shoes and bare arms in a short-sleeve shirt. Mm. And he's carrying my son and places him in his seat. And there's a video camera in the back seat, and Ali sees it and points to it, which I know what he wants. Mm. So I reach to the back seat and get the video camera and turn it on. And he picks Isaac up again and holds him up right beside his head. Ali's head Isaac's head, my six-year-old son Isaac, side by side, is all you see framed in the camera. And Ali says, "This man will be the next champion. He will win the crown in 2020.
Look at the face. 2020.
Yeah, I will be the manager. I'll be 93.
We will be the greatest of that day of all time."
And it was one of the most amazing moments of my life. Right after he did it and I turned off the camera, Ali said, both to Isaac and me, "You will remember this when you're an old, old man."
Davis Miller, by the way, of all the details, one I love the most, after that first extraordinary night, you knock on his mother's door and become best friends. When you get back in your car in shock at what has happened, you turn on the tape deck and there is The Promise of Living from Aaron Copland's Tenderland. It was the second time he'd brought you back from the brink. It was your second promise of living.
He transformed my life in immeasurable ways. I'll love him every moment of my life.
Okay. That's Davis Miller, author of Approaching Ali. Davis, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a substantive treat.
The law firm Cravath, Swain & Moore announced this week that first-year lawyers will see a pay raise this summer for the first time in nearly a decade. Salaries are increasing from $160,000 to $180,000 each year for the first-year law firm associates. They will increase for other associates as well in what's seen as a bellwether for the legal industry. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi there, Jeremy. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, too. And I think for a lot of people, when they hear those salaries, it's like another world. But I guess this does matter. This is kind of a bellwether, not just for the legal industry, but for other industries as well. What's going on here? Why are they increasing the salaries now?
Yeah, that's right. It does sound like a lot of money, but this is all about retention. You know, these firms want to be able to attract and retain the top law graduates coming out, and they felt they had to increase salaries to remain competitive. And as you mentioned, it's a lot of money, but it has been 10 years since there was any kind of substantive pay increase. That's a long time. And for the best talent, you know, they have options out there. They don't have to go to these law firms. They can go into finance. They can go to in-house counsel at companies themselves. They can even go to a startup. So a lot of them sitting there thinking 80 hours a week, is it worth it for that salary? So you're seeing wage pressure.
And there were people who graduated law school and started working at these big law firms back right around the financial crisis.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of lawyers were laid off that year and had to go out and find other professions. Remind us of what happened then during the financial crisis to these firms, because that kind of sets the stage for where we are now.
That's right. And it, you know, that was a job for life. And we were shocked to start to see some of these law firms, in fact, fold and have all these job cuts. And it was the Great Recession, right? It caused all companies, including some of the clients of these law firms. You think banks, but it's other companies as well. They were all looking to cut costs. And many of them started to really push back on these huge legal expenses, especially when they started looking at getting charged big hourly fees for work being done by junior lawyers, some of them who just got out of law school. They said, no. No, we're not going to pay that much. So banks have been cutting costs everywhere. And the other pressure point, I think, really is at the same time you had this competition, as you see in many industries, coming from online providers. Mm. Now, this is more prevalent in the consumer space with companies like LegalZoom and Rocket Lawyer doing wills and simple contracts. I know a lot of people have probably used it themselves. And so some are predicting that also going to move up the food chain to some of those lucrative corporate clients. So you had, I think, both forces, cost cutting coming during the Great Recession, as well as the rise of technology causing a lot of disruptions and pressures in the law industry.
And another pressure on these first-year lawyers is that they've got a lot of money to pay back because they end up out of law school with more than $100,000 in debt in many cases.
Yeah, that's right. And that is a really, really big problem. And again, I think it's causing a lot of them to graduate if they think they want to do law. And they're looking at, you know, how quickly am I going to be able to pay that back? You know, and can I go somewhere else where I'm going to be able to make more of a dent in that? I mean, listen, with that kind of legal debt or student debt, if you're at a top firm, you're probably going to be able to handle it. But what about the kids who don't get into those top firms? The salaries are a lot lower when you're talking about being an independent or a single practitioner. And that is going to be a problem. problem. Some people feel like it's unsustainable, and you're going to see a lot of changes in the law industry. Maybe you're going to move away from the single practitioner being out there and charging on an hourly basis. Maybe you're going to go to flat fees. And some people say it's necessary. There were too many lawyers for a while. Maybe you don't need as many. Maybe you're only going to have them at the very top. Take out that middle area.
Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thanks so much.
Bernie Sanders has accused Hillary Clinton of being part of the establishment. Donald Trump said his comments about the judge handling the Trump University cases were misconstrued earlier in the day. House Speaker Paul Ryan said they were textbook racism. Well, our next guest is hearing echoes of a previous campaign. In 1968, the Southern segregationist George Wallace ran as a third-party candidate. Fights between Ku Klux Klansmen and Black Power activists broke out at his rallies. Senators Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy challenged President Lyndon Johnson for the Democratic nomination. Johnson dropped out, his escalation of the Vietnam War unbearably controversial. Kennedy was assassinated. Vice President Hubert Humphrey wins the nomination, but there's chaos at the Chicago convention. Humphrey then narrowly loses to Republican Richard Nixon, who's helped by the presence of Wallace, who got 13% of the vote. Michael Cohen writes about all of this in his new book, American Maelstrom, the 1968 Election and the Politics of Division. He joins us now. And Michael, first of all, why take this on? So much has been written about 1968.
I was really struck by just how similar sort of the narrative of 68 mimics sort of the narrative of American politics today. It felt to me like this inflection point in American politics. You know, what happened 4 years before 68? In the 64 election, Lyndon Johnson wins 61% of the popular vote, the biggest popular vote margin in American history, pushes through his Great Society agenda. It seems like we have this new era of liberal activism in the country. And then 4 years later, Democrats get 43% of the vote. And lose the White House, and it begins this 30, 40-year period of conservative dominance, for lack of a better word, in American politics. And so sort of asking the question of what happened that year and you know, what is sort of the legacy of 68? Are we still living to some extent in the politics that came out of that year? And one thing I conclude in the book is that we are. And a lot of what we see today in American politics, the images of the two parties in particular, really came out of that election.
Huh. Well, let's remind people. You talk about he pushes through LBJ, his Great Society, Medicare for the aged, Medicaid for the poor, creates the Department of Transportation for better safety laws, the Civil Rights Act, 87 bills in 1 year and 84 are signed. Congress is behind him. The Voting Rights Act, as you write, the nail in the coffin of Jim Crow. But then you also write, by the time we're getting to 68, everyone is angry. Remind us, at who? Why?
You had this extraordinary increase in crime rate throughout the 1960s. You had riots almost every single summer from 64 on. In 67, you had Newark and Detroit. In 68, you had the riots that came after the King assassination. You, of course, had the war in Vietnam, 500,000 American troops in Vietnam. By 67, growing anger of the war, especially on the left. And then you had a larger cultural shift in the country. You know, the counterculture emerges, and you have this generational shift between, you know, kids who had come of age in the era of prosperity in the 50s and 60s and their parents who had come of age during the deprivation of the Great Depression. And they all seem to sort of come together in this 1 year. But what's also unusual is the number of political actors. I mean, you look at it, Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, Bobby Kennedy, Gene McCarthy, Reagan, Rockefeller, Romney, George Wallace. I mean, these are the men who basically defined American politics the second half of the 20th century.
Yeah, we thought we had a crowded field,
right.
You know. But just to back up a second, when I was reading it, I was thinking all those things he pushed through, that's sort of how some people are reacting to President Obama pushing through even just health care. You have the terrible race relations. We're still seeing lynching at this point. We still have terrible race problems now, as headlines from the past year have shown. But that other sense has maybe been transferred to Mexican immigrants. What lines do you see? Where do you see some of the lines?
Well, it's certainly true that the other big social and cultural cleavage in 68 was along racial lines. And there's no question that the white backlash, which had been sort of simmering for quite a few years, really emerged in 68. There was a perception that wasn't really accurate, but there was a perception that Johnson and the Democrats were more focused on helping blacks, helping poor people, than they were in helping the middle class.
Well, it wasn't at all accurate. When you look at all those programs we just listed that helped everybody.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that disproportionately white Americans benefited. But there's a certain reality here that the changes that came about because of the civil rights movement, because of some of the anti-poverty programs, meant that you had blacks moving into white neighborhoods. You had in 68, you had housing reform that basically ended housing discrimination. So all of a sudden, you know, civil rights movement, it may seem something people support. But by 68, you see people actually beginning to experience it directly in their lives. And so a lot of what you see in 68, especially with the support for Wallace, is whites who begin to view the Democratic Party, who they traditionally supported, as somehow working against their interests. Very much you see that same thing today, where people who are economically anxious about their jobs or their wages or their health care, they feel anxious, and there's somebody who comes up, somebody like Trump, who basically scapegoats immigrants and scapegoats poor people and scapegoats minorities, and very much the same way that Wallace did it in the 60s with poor blacks.
Wallace was the third party candidate. Talk more about how you see the two major parties germinating something in 68 that we're seeing now.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, to some extent, the Republicans, you see Richard Nixon running somewhat in the middle of two polar opposites, Nelson Rockefeller on the left and Ronald Reagan on the right. But what you see here very much, especially with the support for Reagan, who was much more to the right even of Nixon, is this new sort of angry anti-government kind of a language coming out of the right that is very much geared around opposing Johnson's Great Society agenda. And so you see this sort of tug of war in the Republican Party, and you see Nixon sort of in the middle, but leaning very much to the right. On the Democratic side, yeah, it's much more about Vietnam. And it primarily comes from, you know, Gene McCarthy, who announces his campaign in the fall of 67 against Johnson, challenges him over the war, almost defeats him in New Hampshire primary. Bobby Kennedy comes in a week later, and within 2 weeks, Johnson dropped out of the race. Yeah. And Vietnam becomes the issue that really defines the Democratic race between March of 68 and the convention in August.
And we've had endless conversations about how it came to define the party, which was
absolutely
said for years to not be able to handle security.
Right.
And, you know, ask you a couple of things that you think people should know, because some of it has been caricatured. For instance, Democratic Senator Eugene McCarthy, who challenges Johnson, an anti-war candidate. But you say much more than that.
Gene McCarthy really energized the anti-war wing of the party. Even after Kennedy got in the race, the anti-war activists stayed with McCarthy by and large. He was also much more liberal than Kennedy. Kennedy was sort of maybe the first example you can think of a third-way Democrat who talked about creating this black, blue-collar coalition. In a sense, he was sort of way ahead of his time. McCarthy's insurgency against Johnson ends up not only toppling Johnson and forcing him from the race, but it really, I think, creates this avenue for liberal activists to begin to play a more active role in the party. So McCarthy's influence really is, I think, pretty significant, very underestimated.
Well, is it also something that you can trace from 68 to 2016?
Yeah, I think every year sort of since 68, you've had this kind of anti-establishment element. You see it right now with Bernie Sanders. I think there is, it's not a direct link, but certainly there is an indirect link between someone like McCarthy and Bernie Sanders and the suspicion of the party establishment, which in 68 was pervasive because of Johnson, because of his lack of candor about the war, and because of, in many ways, his distance from the younger sort of anti-war activists and counterculture activists.
How do we see Donald Trump?
I mean, Donald Trump is George Wallace. And I mean, and
oh, that's, you know, George Wallace was a racist.
Well, I mean, you could say the same thing about Donald Trump, certainly. I mean, I people liked about Wallace and like about Trump is they say what, you know, things that are politically incorrect. They say whatever they want to say. Wallace's wife once said about George that you know, people see him on TV and they all meet the press and say, that's what I would say if I was on TV. And
well,
we hear that a lot from Trump.
And remind us,
as well,
just so, you know, people, what are some of the things Wallace said?
You know, the thing with interesting about Wallace is that he was a New Deal Democrat. He ran that campaign in 68 primarily on racial issues, but on an anti-government agenda. But not anti-government the way we think of it today. Anti-government really towards civil rights, the Supreme Court, but the idea that the government had a responsibility to, you know, spend money on Social Security and Medicare and public education, Wallace supported all those things. And in some ways, that's actually kind of similar to the way Trump is, because Trump doesn't really follow the conservative orthodoxy. And in fact, he's hated by a lot of conservatives, just as Wallace was in 68. But what both of them really have in common is I think they understood how to play on this sense of white anxiety and white fear, but to tie that fear of the other to their economic anxiety. And in 68, it was also about crime. And crime, in my view, was the number one issue in 68, even more so than Vietnam. you know, the same way that Wallace talked about crime, Trump talks about immigration. They aren't the same because crime was a really serious issue in 68. Immigration is not a serious issue as Trump portrays it today. But it's that same idea of playing on that kind of fear. A lot of Republicans ended up adopting Wallace's rhetoric. Wallace's rhetoric, Wallace's appeal really became synonymous with the Republican Party. And I think to a large extent, that's why Trump is doing as well as he has done, because he is, in a sense, George Wallace 48 years later.
And that's the opinion of Michael Cohen. His new book is American Maelstrom, the 1968 Election and the Politics of Division. Michael, thanks so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And you can read an excerpt at herenow.org where you can weigh in. Did 68 shape today's election? Are you sick of hearing about 1968? Wallace, Trump, your thoughts. Let us know.
The leader of the world's largest democracy addressed a joint session of Congress today. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is on his fourth U.S. visit, and in his speech, he evoked Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi and celebrated the ties between the two countries.
The pages of our friendship tell a remarkable story. Today, our relationship has overcome the hesitations of history.
Michael Kugelman is Senior Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Wilson Center. He's with us from Washington. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what struck you about what Modi said in his speech today in Washington?
Well, what really resonated for me was the very heavy emphasis on shared values like democracy and the many shared interests between the two countries. And this is not new. When other Indian prime ministers have given joint addresses to joint sessions of Congress, they've done the same thing. But the timing was so important now because of the presidential election coming. And I think it was clear that Modi was trying to demonstrate that the relationship between the two countries is sufficiently foolproof that it can deal or manage any sort of major leadership transition in the United States. And I think it's a message that he delivered in a very American way, resorting to humor, tapping into cultural cues in the United States. And I think that was very effective.
That in a way he was speaking more to President Obama's successor than to President Obama.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because there's a lot of concern in India about what could happen to the U.S.-India relationship if there were to be a President Trump. I think that in India, many associate Hillary Clinton with the Obama administration, think there wouldn't be much of a difference in the relationship. But Trump is seen in India as a wild card, as he is in this country.
Well, let's listen to another clip from the speech. This is Prime Minister Modi talking about visiting Arlington National Cemetery earlier this week on the anniversary of D-Day.
I honor their courage and sacrifice for the ideals of freedom and democracy.
How would you describe the relationship right now between the U.S. and India?
Well, it's in a very good place, and it's come a very long way. And not too long ago, some decades ago, and particularly during the Cold War era, the U.S. and India really had a dysfunctional relationship. India was very close to the Soviets, and the U.S. simply didn't get along with India. So they've come a very long way. And I would look at 2014 as a key year for two reasons. One, that's when Modi took office, and Modi has made it very clear that he means business, and he wants to get things right in his relationship with the United States. And also in 2014, you had U.S. troops stop fighting a combat war in Afghanistan. And up to that time, the Obama administration tended to look at the broader South Asia region with a very narrowly defined Afghanistan and Pakistan lens, whereas with the U.S. no longer fighting an act of war in Afghanistan, no longer fighting a combat war there, India has come into more focus when it comes to the U.S. strategic lens. And I think a final factor here is that the U.S. has really been intensifying its rebalance to Asia, and Washington envisions a very significant Indian role in that regard, and that it sees India as a key counterbalance to China.
Right. I was going to say it seems like when you think about India today from the U.S. perspective, that one of the main things that policymakers and politicians are trying to deal with is growing China. So that obviously something people are talking about in Washington. But another thing that I saw that the prime minister brought up today was climate change. Let's listen to another clip from the speech.
To live in harmony with Mother Earth is a part of our ancient belief. Our partnership, therefore, aims to balance responsibilities with capabilities. And it also focuses on new ways to increase the availability and use of renewable energy.
Now, a lot of questions right now about what's going to happen with the Paris Agreement on climate change. But when Modi spoke about dealing with climate change today, Democrats in the chamber rose in applause. Most Republicans stayed in their seats. What about that issue?
Yeah, well, climate change is key for the U.S.-India relationship. I mean, people tend to focus on defense and look at that as the pillar of the bilateral relationship, which it is. But if you look at the joint statement released by Obama and Modi yesterday, there are five or six long points about climate change and clean energy. And the U.S. has already been helping provide financing for clean energy projects in India, particularly because Modi really seems on board with scaling up wind and solar power. And I think another area where the U.S. can really contribute, and it was highlighted in the joint statement, is by providing clean energy technology, and particularly for solar power. In India, solar costs have come down, or solar power costs have come down, but what India really needs is the technology that it will allow it to store solar power in a big way. And I think that the U.S. can really contribute something there.
And of course, there have always been questions ever since Modi became prime minister about his past as chief minister of Gujarat and his failure to stop the bloody rioting there. Do you think that he has gotten past that just in the few seconds we have?
Well, I mean, certainly it doesn't really get to him when he's outside of India. I mean, if you look at him on the global stage, he's really transformed himself from a pariah to a pop star. It's really something. But he is reminded of these things in India quite often.
That's Michael Kugelman, Senior Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Wilson Center, as the Indian Prime Minister visits Washington. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.